So, my talk today is going to take us to a remote area of the Western Pacific, Micronesia, and look at human adaptation and agriculture from low-lying atolls to high volcanoes. I'll begin by situating us, then giving a little bit of the history, people moving into this area, then a little bit on geology, some on the soils of these islands and how they're different one from the other, and how people have understood those soils over millennia and grown really good food. And then end with sort of the challenges we face in the 21st century. But before I begin, I must honor two of my most important teachers in the recent past, both from here at the Big Island. To the left, we have Kupuna Erika'anana from Miloli'i, which is just down the road. When my wife brought me from the forests of Cameroon to Hawaii, I was not expecting what I saw. Uncle Eddie took me under his wing, taught me patiently Hawaiian language, and then gave a view into the past, a view into the ancestors, but also how that helps us move forward. One of the things we learned from Uncle Eddie is nana ike kumu, look to the source. At the same time that I was meeting Uncle Eddie in 1994, I met Dr. Goro Uehara, who is an esteemed soil physicist, clay mineralogist in our department. It was back then agronomy and soil science. And Goro was a fantastic scientist, but much more than that, a wonderful mentor. And he always said, you know, science without its relationship to people and history and society is really empty. And so I hold that dear to this day. So I honor these two great Big Island gentlemen. They've both hala, they've passed on, but I think about them often. So with that, let's situate ourselves. You see, on this Google Earth image, we can't even see the islands of Micronesia. Yeah, they're tiny. Yeah, we have Palau in the west. Here's the Philippines. We have the Marianas. This is all yap in here. We don't even see it. And then going across, we have the Marshall Islands. Yeah, so this represents Micronesia. Now, a Micronesian is never happy to be called a Micronesian. I'm a Palauan. I'm a Yapese. I'm from Chuuk. I'm from the Marshall Islands. But they're lumped together as Micronesians. They're each different languages, different cultures. Here we have sort of how they're spread out across the Pacific. Tiny little islands, you know, much, much smaller than the Big Island. Much, much smaller. Yeah. But I'd like to give us a sense of, before we get into the geology and soils, let's think about human movement into this part of the world. Yeah, Palau was the first of these islands to be inhabited. And it's a little bit unclear as to exactly when, but archaeological records and study placed it somewhere about 4,000 years before present. So they were there they've been there a long time. Yeah, there's ancient terraces and pottery that suggests this. Palau to the Marshall Islands is several thousand miles. And so, but very quickly, somewhere around the time of Christ, 2,000 years ago, very adventurous people got on flimsy, what appear to be quite flimsy, but very sturdy sailing canoes, and pretty much colonized all the way to the Marshall Islands very rapidly. So by the time, about 2,000 years ago, all of these islands were populated. And they each developed quite separately in terms of linguistic languages, but share a close tie to, of course, the ocean and the land. In Puente, which is an island I'll talk a little bit of detail in today, Puente has quite a remarkable structure and evidence of a highly developed society. It's called Nan Madol. You can look it up. Some people call it the Venice of the Pacific, but I'd rather call it just Nan Madol. And it's this incredible structure that was built by the Sardalau chiefs and a society showing high organization. These are basalt columns that were carried and placed. Here's my colleague Glenn Fukumoto, and so you can see it's pretty high up. And each one of these basalt columns is several thousand, you know, hundreds of tons to carry. They've got them up there. So developed quite organized societies. And then the first European contact with the Spaniards, Magellan, the explorers, ended up circumnavigating the globe and passed by the Marianas and Palau and these small islands in the 1500s. But the Spanish contact was not very deep. It was sort of hit and miss. They didn't establish strong colonies, let's say, in these islands. But the missionaries were quite effective. In fact, I like to say they outdid themselves in Micronesia. Yeah, so the missionary influence was very strong and transformed life in these islands. And that was followed by now big changes. In the late 19th century, the Germans came in, and they were really interested in the resources that they found in these islands. In Nauru, for example, or southern Palau, we have phosphate islands. Yeah? So they mined phosphate for fertilizer. They also transformed the vegetation of these islands because they were the first to really intensively plant coconut for copra. So the landscape changed forever with the plantations of copra. There wasn't a very good relationship between the indigenous peoples of Palau and Pohnpei. In fact, there were uprisings. So there was tension, as you might imagine. The Germans lost World War I, and the Japanese come in. And again, the Japanese saw places for good agriculture. The island of Tinian in the Marianas during the Japanese time was covered in sugarcane, completely covered, all sugarcane. In Pohnpei, they had extensive plantations of pineapple and whatnot. So the Japanese, of course, were also interested in the resources, but they were also interested in the geopolitical. They set up military bases, and that brought about a very devastating time for these islands, which was World War II. We talked to the elders of this part of the world, and they don't want to remember World War II. It was a time of great violence, bombings, and you know, some of the bloodiest battles, Peleliu in Palau. And you go there and you feel this real sense of real suffering. The United States took over after World War II, and it became the Trust Territories. And the United States brought another way of looking at the world, a market economy, consumerism, canned meat, Budweiser, all kinds of things that forever changed the landscape, and not necessarily for the better, as we'll see in a little bit. And, of course, the nuclear testing program in the Marshall Islands, which, you know, it's really surprising how little is known of this, of the younger generation. But it was a time of great violence to the land and to people. And that completely changed the Marshall Islands. And to this day, Marshallese bear that weight, both in disease but in memory. Independence came at different times for the different islands. The Marshall Islands in 1976, they were the first. The Federated States of Micronesia, which makes up four states, Yap, Palau, Yap, Pohnpei, Chuuk, and Kosrae, in 1986. And then Palau is the latest in 1994. But they are really dependent on the United States. They haven't separated. The Compact of Free Association, which allows the U.S. free rein for military ships and other military strategic operations. In return, what appears to be a large sum of money, the last one was negotiated, I believe, at $20 million, $60 million, but it's created a dependence, a great dependence. So today I want to just spend a little bit of time looking at three of the islands, Palau, Pohnpei, and then the atolls of the Marshall Islands. Palau is in the far west. It's made up of many islands. It's an archipelago. I'll speak mostly about the big island of Palau called Babaldap. And let's begin with the geology. Geology is the beginning of the land and plants and soils, right? What did this form from? Yeah, so Palau is the result of a subduction zone, the Pacific Plate, going underneath the Philippine Plate and producing an arc volcano So you see the magma is produced by the friction of this subduction zone, and then you have the arc volcanoes. The Marianas Islands, for example, you've heard of Guam. These are all arc volcanoes. Palau is much older, though. So the rock, the substrate for Palau is somewhere around 20 to 40 million years old. And the big island, or Babeldaob, is still the remnant, the remnants of the subsiding shield volcano. And it's primarily basalt and andesite as apparent rock. To the south, however, are all limestone-bearing islands, which are results of subsidence and then uplift and coral formation. So they're all coral-based. Very importantly are the alluvial deposits in the small valleys that you see fringing the coastlines. These alluvial deposits are probably the most important geologic features of Palau in terms of agriculture, and we'll get to that in a minute. Puente, like Hawaii, is a hot spot, the result of hot spot volcanism. So part of the Carolinas volcanism, and hot spot, of course, is just the plate moving across an area in the mantle where magma is escaping. Palau is in this stage of development, so it's a subsiding volcano with a fringing reef, yeah, with a barrier reef, I should say, and we'll see some pictures later. So there were two main volcanic eruptions in Palau, the second having two stages, but the first going back to about 8.5 million years ago, producing a shield volcano, much like what we see here in Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea. And then subsidence, and then a resurgence of volcanism over several 2 million years, well, more actually, 7 million years of renewed activity, which built another edifice of basalt on top of that. And then we get the weathered remains of both, which produce different soils. We also have the fringing reef, which allowed for the growth of mangrove forests, which are very important in Puente. And we don't have nice beaches as you might see here in the Hawaiian Islands because the coastlines are mostly mangrove, but it protects the land. And then lastly, the atolls of the Marshall Islands. Yeah, there are 29 atolls that make up the Marshall Islands, covering about 2 million square miles of ocean, two chains. But an atoll is just the remnants of a submerged volcano. Yeah, so here's they've studied Bikini Atoll quite extensively, as you might expect, because of the nuclear testing there. And you see you have the remnants of the volcano, basalt, some 1,400 meters below, and then the building of limestone reef on top of that. And then just a sliver of land remains. I won't go into, you know, taxonomy, soil taxonomy, you know, like a anionic acroperox, you know. But we learn much from that, as some of you are rightfully, you know, we learn. And I thank Goro for really teaching me the intricacies of soil formation, morphology, and classification, which allows me now when I go work in Guinea, West Africa, and I know this is a ferrosol, I already have a picture in my mind what kind of soil we're going to be working with, yeah, just because of classification and the knowledge we get from it. So Palau is an old island. You know, it's been an island for as much as 40 million years. It rains a lot in Palau, over 3 meters of rain a year, and it's warm. And so we have high weathering intensity. And what's the result of high weathering intensity in an equatorial climates? Oxisols, red, iron rich. But in this case, because andesite is the parent, we have a lot of aluminum. So this subsoil here is basically aluminum toxic. The Japanese recognized that, and what did they do? They mined aluminum, gibbsite, right? Bauxite. And there are still old remnants on the landscape of Babeldaob showing where the Japanese bauxite mines were. Nonetheless, highly weathered, very often aluminum toxic in the subsoil, and very low fertility. However, when you travel to Babeldaob, it's just a mass of green. The forest is dense. So the thin organic layer in the surface is the fertility of the soil. and the biota inhabiting that region, the rhizosphere, mycorrhiza, and all of the other microbiome that keep forests healthy. But not all of Palau is anoxisol. In these valleys, coastal valleys that I was mentioning before, were poorly drained, we have accumulation of organic matter, slow decomposition, and we now have histosols there. So histosols are just organic rich soils. And these are the soils that sustain Palauan society for thousands of years. It is here that the Palauans planted their food crops, the most important being taro. We heard our colleague outside earlier speak of Haloa, the firstborn. Well, the Palauans also have a close relationship with the taro. Yeah. On the limestone parent to the south, we have the island of Peleliu, which is famous for the battle that was fought there in 1944 or 45, I can't remember. But it has very fertile soils, mollisols. You know, soils like you might find in the Midwest. Of course, they're not the same mollisols as that of Illinois, but high base saturation, near neutral pH to maybe going towards alkaline, and rich in nutrients. Yeah. So, very productive. So here's just some data. I won't spend too much time here. I just want to highlight here that in these oxisols, the high organic matter in the surface layer, this is 9.6% organic carbon. So that's, you know, almost 15% organic matter. Yeah? That's a high organic matter soil. And that's where fertility resides. You see calcium accumulates there, the cation exchange capacity associated with organic matter. And the most important thing is aluminum toxicity is much reduced. Why? Because organic matter chelates aluminum. However, you don't go too very deep down here in the red subsoil at 20 centimeters and you have 75% aluminum saturation. Well, you're not going to be growing a lot of vegetables in a soil with 75% aluminum saturation. So the organic matter plays a key role in maintaining fertility. Over the years, fire, mismanagement of land, deforestation, what has happened? Clear the land. 3 meters of rainfall, what happens? You lose the surface layer, and now you have the badlands of bobbled up, which is land that has been eroded away, and the subsoil is now at the surface, and you can't grow anything in it, because you've got, in some cases, we've measured, done some soil survey work there, you know, 90% aluminum saturation. Doing a reforestation project in that kind of environment is very challenging. On the other hand, the valley soils, poorly drained, organic-rich histosols are near neutral, the influence of the carbonates, right, from the coral sand, and very high in organic matter, they're histosols, and very productive and fertile. And they remain, to this day, the most important agricultural soils in Palau. Here is just a few years ago, unlike Hawaii and other parts of the Pacific, men are not allowed in the wetland taro patch. It's strictly a woman's job to grow the taro. And taro is the number one food crop in a traditional Palauan diet. And you can see how deep this soil is. It's all organic matter. Okay? And to this day, they farm it as they farmed it 1,000 years ago. No inputs. Cover the patch with a sort of thatch like a palm leaf to keep weeds down, and they grow quite good taro. In fact, the Palauan taro has partly saved the taro industry here in Hawaii, because Palauan taro has a resistance to Phytophthora. So some of our researchers went down to Palau and got some of their varieties and did some crosses, and we have Palauan crosses now here in Hawaii. Polyculture. Agroforestry is the foundation of all the islands I'll speak of. I'll spend more time on Pohnpei to discuss this, but really it's a mishmash of banana. In Palau, it's banana, taro, coconut, betel nut. Betel nut is really important in Palau. When you go to Palau, you get used to seeing people with a big bulge in their mouth and very red lips. And you have to watch trajectories of red spittle. Nonetheless, every now and again, it's not bad to have a chew of betel nut. It gives you a little bit of a rush. In the hot sun, nothing like that, yeah? Cassava has become an important crop because it can grow almost anywhere. Cassava is quite well suited to very acid, poor soils, and I learned that when I was in Cameroon, which also has oxisols, the rainforest of Cameroon, and we ate cassava every day. Pohnpei, Younger Island, different soils, okay? Alfasols, we know alfasols, you can think of these deciduous forest soils of the Midwest as you get into the more wet areas. Yeah, these are alfasols, relatively high base saturation, a little bit acidic, can be acidic because of high rainfall and some leaching, but quite productive soils. Most of the interior of Pohnpei on the newer substrate, the newer volcanics, are alfasols, and it's all forest. Nobody lives up in the forest. And that's good, actually. It protects the island. Some of the wettest places in the world are the sand, none allowed. It's about 1,000 meters high. It rains all the time. It's completely covered in clouds. So mostly deep forest soils and mostly native. These inceptisols on the steep lands, on the older substrates, so where there's a mix of old and new substrate here, are a little bit more acid, more shallow, steeper, but they are very important agricultural soils for the Pohnpeian, and we'll discuss that in a minute. And then we have, bottom land inceptisols, which are poorly drained alluvial soils in the bottomlands, and guess what they might have grown in these lands? Of course, it's taro again. But the Pohnpeian was expert in the swamp taro, the giant swamp taro, which I'll show some pictures of in a little bit. Oxisols on the very old landscapes. So these are the very old remnants of the first eruption phase. And we have highly weathered oxisols. A little bit similar to those you would find in Palau, except aluminum saturation is not quite as high because these are basalt volcanoes and no andesite, which reduces the aluminum, amount of aluminum. Okay, here are some. You know, they might be acid, but relatively high in organic matter and relatively enriched in cations and some aluminum. So if you're planting a Western style vegetable and you don't take care of this aluminum, you're in trouble. Oxisols, they appear somewhat like those we find in Palau, except for lower aluminum saturation, but nonetheless, for vegetable crops, could be problematic. The inceptisols in the lowlands are the taro lands. There are also histosols, but the histosols are really in marshes, so the Pohnpeian leaves them alone, fortunately. Yeah, so they just behave as wetlands. Very fertile soils, high calcium, high magnesium, no aluminum problems, rich in organic matter, lots of nitrogen turnover, good for taro. So let's take a moment and look at the Pohnpeian agroforest. My first trip to Pohnpei was, I think, in 2009. And, you know, you kind of show up in a place and you're like, ooh, wow, go around. And it's a very small island. You can drive around the island in about 3 hours. And so, of course, the first day we drive around. And I just saw forests look like jungle to me. Yeah. But then, you know, you get invited into people's houses. You take a walk. And very quickly you realize, wow, this really isn't a jungle. Yeah. So it's all food. Yeah. It's a little bit difficult in this picture to see this. You got coconut, you've got yams growing up this coconut tree, you've got breadfruit in there, you've got taro here, yeah, papaya, bananas. Okay, so it's a rich garden. I hear people call it, you know, they call it food forest. Yeah, but this has been going on for thousands of years in Pohnpei, and there are no inputs other than sunlight, rainfall, and mussels. Yeah. So, low input, biodiverse. I'll show a couple slides just to show the diversity of these systems. Stable and resilient. Yeah. So, you know, if there's a dry spell, it's very rare. Even today in this time of climate change, although things are starting to affect Pohnpei, it's very rare to go 2 weeks without rain in Pohnpei. That's a rarity. But even if you do go 2 weeks, last year there was a drought, a month without rain, these forests withstood it. right? Deep root systems, it didn't bother them. Yeah? So resilient and stable, they're always producing food. There's always coconuts around, breadfruit, yeah, banana, papaya, yam. Yeah? They're efficient. Yeah? For the amount of labor you put in and the amount you get out, it's quite high. Yeah? And first and foremost, it protects the island. It's a forest. Little runoff, not much leaching. Well, you're not adding fertilizer, so you don't have any kind of source of contamination from this type of forest, yeah? Seems a perfect, huh? We should all be doing this. Well, it doesn't always work everywhere. What's the key here? Rainfall. Pohnpei, like Palau, is about over 3 meters of rain a year. It's a lot of rain. So, food forest. Some cleared, you know, they're clearing the native trees, but just replacing them with breadfruit and coconut and whatnot. And here's a good friend of mine. You know, he likes cassava, so he clears a little bit more and plants cassava. Yeah, rich food. Yeah, I've worked over the last few years. I've been working with nutritionists, and I didn't realize the amount of nutrients in these native tree crops and root crops. Breadfruit is loaded with different types of vitamins, carbohydrate. It's almost an all around food. And as one of my colleagues, Dr. Lincoln, you know, he's done a lot of work with breadfruit. It's just, people are just starting to realize the value of this tree crop. Yeah. The swamp taro. Hawaiians never grew swamp taro. There's almost no work. Once you plant a swamp taro, you plant the huli, which is the cutting, you put it in the swampy soil. I told you there are histosols. You leave it alone. It can stay there 10 years. Now, I'll show a picture later. This is a small one. I've seen a swamp taro corm this big, weighed over 30 pounds. Yeah. Loaded with nutrients. Little dry to the taste when you first eat it, but with time, very good. And then all manner of banana. All manner, all kinds of colors. Very rich in nutrients. You know, we think of, well, my daughter's now pretty picky. Oh, Dad, what kind of banana is that? Chiquita, no, I don't eat that. Where's the local one, right? Okay, so bananas, quite an art, yeah? So, here is from our good friend Bill Rayner, who suddenly passed last year, but he did a lot of work in Pohnpei. He was a Peace Corps volunteer as well, got his master's at UH, and then went back, and he became a chief, highly respected foreigner in Pohnpei. And he did really, really good work characterizing the agroforest. So several papers published, and what you see is just a tremendous, it's like a horticultural smorgasbord. Yeah? You've got all kinds of 92 different coconut varieties, 72 breadfruit varieties, 110 plantain, you know, all manner. Yeah? So they were good horticulturalists, the Pohnpeian. Today, we went back as part of a big health study. And we were quite interested with, well, how's the agroforest doing in 2016? You know, that study was done in 1993. Palau has changed. Palau, they don't grow as much. But Pohnpei has remained an agroforest society. And here's just a sampling of 2 villages, 10 households in each village, randomly selected, and then gone and done some counting. All manner of plants. And this is what looks to be a jungle. Doesn't look managed at all. I was like, hey, what's all the weeds for? But it's all food. Yeah, food. Atolls. I did my PhD research in the Marshall Islands. It was quite by accident, but most things happen by accident. Thank goodness, yeah? Otherwise, man, it'd be pretty boring, huh? I finished my master's with Dr. Uehara, and I went, and I was happy as a clam, you know, surfing big waves in Makaha and working on a farm. My wife wasn't so... She was like, brah, you're only making $14,000 a year. Ah, Malia, but look at all the food we're eating. And that wave today was unreal. So anyway, Dr. Yost, my PhD mentor, he called me up and said, hey, Jonathan, I need somebody like you to go to the Marshall Islands. What? Why me? Well, I know you can handle it. Well, what do you want me to do? You're going to get on a boat and go to like all these different isolated atolls and collect soil samples for me. Oh, yeah? You paying me? Yeah, I'll pay you to get... Okay, I'll do it. So I was gone for a little over a month, collecting soil samples and really, talk about remote and isolated atolls with people still living there. Yeah? Okay. This is Arno. You know, this is about 300 meters from here to here. There are 6 soil map units according to soil survey. Oh, wow, that sounds like plenty of different kinds of soils in there. Not really. Yeah? 2 soils. The Majuro, Sandy Skeleton. Now we do soil classification, folks. Remember your classification? Sandy Skeletal Carbonatic Isohypothermic Typic Eudorthens. Jesus, what the heck is that? Okay, and then we have carbonatic, isothermic, isohypothermic, typic UD sediments. Well, they're both wet, yeah? They're both carbonate mineralogy, so what's the pH going to be? High, right? 8 or more. Ent, both entisols, that makes sense, recent. Yeah, they're pretty recent. They keep getting new coral added to them, yeah? They're, how high, what's the elevation of an atoll? Average elevation of the Marshall Islands. 3 feet above sea level. So we over here are waffling about climate change and sea level rise. And every full moon or king tide, what happens in Majuro? The whole island gets inundated. Yeah. Just type in climate change in the Marshall Islands and you'll see some pretty harrowing pictures. Yeah, but we see them today happening. There you go. Stony, fine sand. That's all it is. How in the heck you got plants growing on these atolls? Organic matter. That's the key. Okay? So, lots of calcium, lots of magnesium, not much potassium, not much phosphorus. The nitrogen comes from relatively high organic carbon, and you get an amazing agroforest. Amazing. When I first went and we collected all of these soils, I was never hungry in the Marshall Islands, never. We had breadfruit, coconut crab, any kind of fish you wanted. You just go out in the lagoon, 2 minutes, you got a tuna right there, come back, all kinds of food. Now it was limited, right? Breadfruit, coconut, fermented breadfruit. The first time I had to eat that, it was a little bit strange. I mean, it didn't smell very good, but you know, you get used to it, yeah? This is the taro that I was mentioning. Yeah? Look at that thing. Yeah? That'll feed a big family. Yeah. Okay. No inputs. Breadfruit. Pandanus. The Micronesians have all varieties of pandanus. Very rich in vitamin A. Yeah, they make a juice out of it. They do all kinds of things with pandanus. And pandanus grows in the most inhospitable environment. What I was going to say is when we collected all of these soil samples, we brought them back to the lab at UH Manoa, and of course I had to do all of the soil analysis, and we kept getting numbers like trace amounts of potassium, very low phosphorus. And so, you know, from a trained soil scientist agronomy perspective, oh, these soils are all deficient. They're no good for agriculture. And then I was thinking, but man, I ate every day from that forest. And we were taught that a banana tree needs a lot of potassium in the soil. Well, you go take a soil sample and the potassium is 50 parts per million. Oh my God, that's like extremely deficient. So we have much to learn from our ancestors, Nanaikekumu. So we're at a crossroads. How am I doing? 10 more minutes. Okay, we're at a crossroads. And it's a lot more serious and scary when you're in the Marshall Islands than it is here. Yeah, a lot. Because you're right at the front lines. Yeah. But first, islands at a crossroad. Transition from a rural agrarian society. But they traveled. They were travelers. How did they travel? They were expert navigators. There was much travel between these islands. Rural agrarian society who could live quite a good life on a very tiny piece of land with an agroforest and a rich marine refrigerator. Yeah. To now, it's hard to see on the slide, this is Ebi. Yeah. This is the result of nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands. Take them away from Bikini and Eniwetok and Rongorik and Rongelap and put them on, relocate them. Well, this is where they've ended up. And it's an urban nightmare. There's not a green leaf anywhere to be seen, but they're pacified with handouts from the U.S. government, which has resulted in some very serious problems that I'll get to in a minute. So urbanization. In this case, this is extreme, very extreme. But in Palau, what's happening in Palau? 80% of the population now lives in Koror. They don't produce food anymore, so they import now. So now you get importing of food rather than the food that you grew before, which has really led to some very serious health issues. Yeah. So you go from a nutrient-dense, albeit limited diet, but nutrient-dense, coupled with the marine resources, yeah, quite a good, healthy diet, plus active, to import. And guess what's being imported? The worst of the worst. Spam, ramen, Budweiser. Yeah? I mean, at least bring a good microbrew. Okay. There you go. That's a typical shelf, the shelves of a modern supermarket in Pohnpei. This has led to some very startling and disturbing health statistics. What used to be probably quite healthy people, now there probably were other, you know, populations weren't exploding, but they do say that the population of Palau prior to European colonization was around 40,000 people. Today it's about just a little bit less than that. So this diet sustained quite a large population. Now we have some of the most startling health statistics on the planet. Low activity. So the Compact of Free Association has brought money to the islands, but it's promoted a sedentary lifestyle, and it's not that much money. Salaries in Pohnpei, you know, an instructor at the college is earning about $11,000 a year. Now that's a coveted job, and it's a good job actually. Teaching, we like to teach, but living, pardon? Yeah, these are percents. Sorry, yep, percent. So obesity, these numbers have gone up actually. This is data from 2010. So you know, a heavier and heavier population. And with that, you have all of the diseases that come along with it. Palau is no longer 22. It's closer to 40% now and higher. So you have very high diabetes, hypertension, risk for non-communicable diseases. And the end result is people dying younger and younger. Yeah. So it's a real problem. I'm not sure if there's an easy answer, but people recognize it and are taking steps to. So climate change, again, you know, we don't need to repeat it too often, but the effects are pretty disturbing. Here's the latest king tide effect in Majuro, which normally this is just, you know, it's just a forest of coconut. Yeah, here's the ocean overrunning it. In the taro lands that do remain in Palau, salinization, small levels and sea rise. Remember, those agricultural lands are in the bottomlands, on the coastal bottomlands. And so the salt is coming in, saltwater intrusion, and it's having an effect on taro production because taro is not salt tolerant. So quite a bit of research going on how to develop salt tolerant, more tolerant varieties for taro production. A Pohnpeian of this gentleman's age, and maybe a little bit my age and above, all recognize the value of the agroforest, and for the most part are all engaged. Even if they hold a job at the state government, on the weekends they're in the agroforest, planting or harvesting. In the Pohnpeian way of life, the bank account was the breadfruit trees you planted. That's the bank account, the savings account. Yeah. So how do we transfer and maintain that you know, recognition of the value of that system in a time when young people don't seem to see that. And everything that's being thrown at them is anathema to the agroforest. So how do we transfer that knowledge? It's not transferred at the college agriculture program. We've been writing grants to bring in, you know, traditional knowledge back into the agriculture program at the associates level. It's hard to get money these days, yeah. Augment agroforest with high value crops. So there's a push to, you know, plant within your agroforest some high value cabbages, cucumbers, coffee, yeah. But in an oxisol or in a low fertility atoll soil, the agroforest might have thrived due to the natural system, but these cabbages, they need a lot of what right away? Nitrogen, yeah. So we work closely with, well, you've got pigs. That's a whole other story. No time today for the pigs, yeah? But the pigs are putting all of their beautiful nutrients right into the stream every day, all day. This, we did some studies with the pig farmers, and we calculated all of the different nutrients they were throwing away into the stream. And, you know, pig waste is causing all kinds of problems. Yeah. In fact, this paper came out just about the time we were over there, and leptospirosis was a huge problem because the kids finish school and where do they go? There's no beaches in Pohnpei because of the mangrove. They go into the stream. There are hundreds of streams in Pohnpei. What's going into the stream water every day? Pig manure. Okay? So we couple that, composting piggeries. We spent 5 or 6 years going back and forth, talking story, building examples, working with community groups. Dry litter piggeries, they work well. You house your pigs in a good environment. It's clean, wood chips, no flies. You take that urine, feces-soaked wood chip, put it in a composting pile right next to that, and you produce high-value compost that now you can grow really good vegetables with if you want to. And it's right there, contained, no imports. Yeah, in the case that I showed there, they built with cement. Okay, that was brought in. But we have farmers there, they built it out of their own coconut, you know, different bamboo walls and whatnot. So, one thing that is really important is, I learned in the Peace Corps, you know, you get people change not because you tell them they're going to change. They change because they see something, and, oh, wow, or they see their neighbor do something. Hey, man, why is that guy doing that? So there's been some success, you know. They've gotten together as communities, built these piggeries with no outside funds, raised the money, or the government recognized, the local government recognized the value. And so, but change is slow. 8 piggeries after 5 years of work? I don't know. Is that a success story? I'm not sure, yeah? Summary. This area is blessed with some of the most stupendous natural beauty you might ever see. It's blessed with people who are resilient, hospitable. They'll give you the right off the back of you, whatever they have to bring you in. And a long and rich history and culture. Their agroforest system has sustained them well. In Pohnpei, it's recognized. Yap, it's recognized. In the outer islands of Chuuk, it's recognized. But where the influence from the outside world has been stronger, Palau and the Marshall Islands, they're losing that knowledge. I'll end by just saying, you know, we do this work because we like people, yeah? And right in the middle is the next generation, the children of the future, yeah? They're always around in Micronesia, running everywhere, you know? They're not in a room playing PlayStation or I don't know what people do. The cell phone is kind of changing things, you know, everybody's got a cell phone anyway. But these are colleagues that I work with, farmers associations, women's associations, nutritionists, college instructors, government officials, and then farmers, motivated farmers, yeah? So, and my colleagues here from Extension. Mahalo nui, yauko.
Thank you, Jonathan. On behalf of the ASHS membership, I would like to present you with this honorary membership in ASHS as the Tex Frazier Lecturer for this year. At NC State, my soil science colleagues like to remind me quite frequently of how much horticulture depends on soil. And I think what Dr. Dienick did was just a fascinating story, bringing that point to home, how much all of what we do depends on the soils, and weaving that in with the horticulture, and then, of course, with the people living on the land. So again, thank you very much. Dr. Dienick will be around. I'm sure there are questions, and he'll be able to answer them. I would like to introduce on the stage also Paul Bosland, former ASHS president and chair of the ASHS Awards Committee. He'll be helping me here to distribute the awards. We are going to start with the premier ASHS award, and that's the Hall of Fame. As you know, the Society gives its most prestigious award to honor distinguished persons who have made monumental and unique contributions to horticulture. The Horticulture Hall of Fame Award to educate and increase the awareness of our younger members of the profession and the general public about the important contributions of horticultural pioneers who have made significant impacts on horticulture. ASHS is exceptionally pleased to induct an outstanding contributor to horticulture into the Hall of Fame this year. It is with great pleasure and honor for me to present this year's Hall of Fame, ASHS Hall of Fame Award to Wilson Popino. Wilson Popino, famed horticulturist, botanist, and agricultural explorer, was one of the most influential figures during the 20th century in Central American agriculture, plant science, and education. He used science to improve food availability, medicine, create sustainable lifestyles, and educate. He led global popularization of his beloved avocado. Now over 1 million commercial tons are produced each year. He blazed trails through valleys and mountains, seeking and collecting avocados, citrus, and other fruits of value, and was known in Guatemala as El Gringo Aguacatero. These, in his USDA Office of Seed and Plant Introductions, have left his initials deeply carved in horticulture with a professional career any plantsman would envy. His 1920 Manual of Tropical and Subtropical Fruits still introduces many little-known fruits to horticulturists and growers. Popino's creation of Lanzantilla Botanical Garden in Tela, Honduras, led to his directorship of all tropical research for United Fruit Company, which subsequently led to the introduction of hundreds of varieties of tropical plants and new crops. Responding to one of the great unmet needs in Central America, Popino created an agricultural school with practical scientific courses, Escuela Agricultura Panamericana Zamorano University. As its first rector, he embedded the style and educational methodology of learn by doing for 16 years, instilling his vision, spirit, and passion in hundreds of Latin American students. Retiring to his home in Antigua, Guatemala, he remained active at Zamorano. Popino's legacy transcends time, geography, and culture. His spirit and philosophy planted in the hearts of generations of Zamoranos. Here to accept the award on behalf of the family is Juanita Popino, his grandniece. We invite Juanita to make a few comments. As a note for the award recipients, we will be taking pictures afterwards as well.
Thank you. It's a great honor to receive this on behalf of my great uncle. He was a brilliant man, a gifted raconteur, and an intrepid explorer. He was very fortunate to have a job with the United Fruit Company under Mr. Zamore, who also supported him in his vision for this research and demonstration garden for promising new crops and hands-on education for young growers. And I think, well, these benefits obviously are shown in worldwide as well as Central America, very important for our horticultural crops. So thank you.
It is my honor to begin the presentation of the 2017 class of ASHS Fellows. There are members of the Society who have made such outstanding contributions to horticulture in research, teaching, and extension, or administration, on national and international levels. Each year, a small number of those members are selected and named as ASHS Fellows. As I prepared for this meeting, I was struck by two characteristics shared by all of these individuals: their passion and their desire to make an impact. It is clear that they love what they do, and they have strived to change people's lives, change the science, and in some cases, the planet. It is my honor today to announce to you the 53rd class of fellows of the American Society of Horticultural Science. If you could please come to the stage when I call your name to receive your award. To begin with, Neil Anderson, University of Minnesota. Dr. Neil Anderson. Sounds like Neil brought his fan club. Dr. Neil Anderson grew up in a small Vermont dairy farm that instilled in him a love for plants early on. To embark on his formal education, he studied ornamental horticulture at California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo. After completing his BS, he joined the floriculture breeding research team at the University of Minnesota, led by Drs. Richard Widmer and Peter Asher. After graduation, he became a flower breeder, potted plant product manager, and new crop development specialist with Pan American Seed Company. In this position, he had the opportunity to work with world-famous flower breeders, learn the intricacies of flower crop domestication, and negotiate the first-ever Convention on Biological Diversity-Driven Industry-Government Agreement to domesticate new flower crops and remunerate South African citizens. His passions are flower breeding, conducting long-term high-risk research, and educating students. This led him to join the faculty at the University of Minnesota in 1999 to direct the flower breeding and genetics program. As an educator, advisor, and mentor, he has had the privilege of positively influencing hundreds of undergraduate and professional students who are now in a variety of horticulture careers. He has developed a research program in flower breeding and genetics to enhance cold tolerance to maximize herbaceous perennial plant survival, a good thing for Minnesota, created novel ornamentals, and bridge knowledge gaps for informed decision-making in preventing invasive crops. This has resulted in the publication of 40 peer-reviewed publications by his research team in the past 8 years alone. His research has led to the discovery of novel plant phenotypes such as winter hardy interspecific shrub chrysanthemums, ground cover garden chrysanthemums, winter hardy gladiolus, and seed-propagated reflowering lilies. He has bred and introduced a total of 35 cultivars and germplasm releases during his career, covering a wide range of floriculture crop uses. Congratulations. Neil and I went to grad school together just a few years ago. Next ASHS fellow, Thomas Bjorkman, Cornell University. Unfortunately, Thomas could not be with us this year. Dr. Marvin Pritz will accept the award on his behalf. Dr. Thomas Bjorkman's pedigree in plant physiology and development reads like a chapter out of a textbook. He used fundamental understanding of the biology of plants to improve vegetable production and agricultural sustainability for growers across the eastern United States. Dr. Bjorkman received his B.S. in biochemistry at UC Davis and Ph.D. in botany at Cornell with Carl Leopold, a name well known to many. After postdoctoral training with Cleveland at University of Washington, he took a faculty position in horticulture at Cornell in 1990 and has worked his way up through the ranks with his current appointment, a split of research and extension. His research has contributed to our understanding of floral development, gene regulation in broccoli and cauliflower, stimulated by sabbatical leave with Robert Goldberg at UCLA. He currently leads a large multidisciplinary project funded by the USDA aimed at developing new broccoli cultivars for the eastern United States. Among other projects, he has been a leader in optimizing cover crop systems for vegetable production in northeast United States, as well as the development of buckwheat cultivars adapted to regional conditions. Bjorkman has authored more than 60 extension fact sheets and production guides and over 40 peer-reviewed publications. Although he has served in leadership roles in many important ASHS activities and interest groups throughout the years, his leadership with the ASHS National Issues Task Force Committee is his signature accomplishment. This group has worked to expand funding to the USDA Specialty Crops Research Initiative, as well as raising the profile of horticultural science research nationally. In closing, his commitment to translating research into results that meet the needs of industry have earned the respect and praise of growers and extension educators, while his service to ASHS is exemplary. And as I said, Dr. Marvin Pritz will be accepting the award on his behalf. I will take also a moment to mention the national issues. We'll be having a session later this week with politicians, several representatives, and I know he'd want us all to be there. Peter Hurst, Purdue University. All right. Dr. Peter Hurst works closely with the tree fruit industry to help them adapt to changing times. Within Indiana, he cooperates with growers operating at all scales and levels of expertise to help them be successful. Many fruit growers are conservative and often reluctant to change their practices. Actually, I'd say that probably applies to many of us. He has worked to demonstrate the value of new practices to growers. A few examples of his programs are: his beginning apple grower workshops have educated over 250 growers over 10 years, 88% of whom said they would change their practices in response to the workshops. He's the fruit program coordinator and overall conference chair of the Indiana Horticultural Congress. He developed a new pruning system for old trees named by growers the Hoosier Hatchet. That's pretty darn cool. Through his involvement in the NC-140 Regional Research Project, he developed specific rootstock recommendations for growers and guided growers through the implementation process, encouraging the industry to move away from trees grown on vigorous rootstocks that are dependable but inefficient and labor-intensive to manage. Dr. Hurst's research program addresses the needs of growers by focusing on finding solutions to immediate problems while also conducting longer-term mechanistic studies to provide further knowledge of the underlying processes. His three areas of focus are apple flower formation, fruit development, and tree architecture and automation. To conduct this research, he collaborates not only with horticulturists, but also with molecular biologists, bioinformaticians, engineers, industrial developers, computer graphic modelers, economists, and sociologists. His research has been funded through competitive federal, state, and industry grants, totaling more than $7 million, as well as support from the Indiana tree fruit industry. Dr. Hurst has been invited to present his research to many national and international audiences. He's a frequent speaker at meetings across the country, as well as in many other countries, including Australia, Canada, China, Egypt, Kazakhstan. I don't think too many of us have gone to Kazakhstan. Mexico, and New Zealand. Yi Li, University of Connecticut and Nanjing Agricultural University. Dr. Yi Li is a professor in the Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture at University of Connecticut. He received his B.S. in 1982 from Beijing Forestry University and his Ph.D. in 1989 from SUNY Syracuse. His early career research focused on molecular regulation of plant hormones, but now he focuses on the application of molecular genetics for horticulture crop improvement. Dr. Li has received over $8 million in competitive grant awards, published 85 research articles, and edited or contributed to 9 books. His early career discoveries are featured in 7 plant biology textbooks. Over the past 20 years, he's developed several commercially important technologies for horticulture crop improvement. Gene Deleter was developed to mitigate environmental and food safety concerns over GMOs and holds great potential for the application of asexually propagated crops. Dr. Li founded the New England Invasive Plant Center to combat habitat damage from non-native species, and he recently developed triploid hybrids of burning bush to eliminate the invasive characteristics of this valuable ornamental. Dr. Lee also developed a transgenic seedless fruit technology for improving fruit quality and yield, and recently developed a simple and effective two-step procedure for isolating mutant plants with targeted traits. He used this technology to develop 18 perennial ryegrass lines that are shade tolerant and naturally dwarf, so they require less frequent mowing. And in a very timely project as well, he is currently developing technologies for using CRISPR to produce non-transgenic HLB-resistant citrus cultivars. Dr. Lee has delivered 142 invited keynote plenary addresses or lectures at international, national, and regional conferences, served on review panels for NIH, DOE, NASA, and USDA, served as associate editor for 6 international journals, and remains active in ASHS. He chaired ASHS interest groups, organized workshops, and served on ASHS committee. So again, let's congratulate Dr. Lee. James Mathias, USDA, ARS, Tree Fruit Research Laboratory. Dr. Mathias has been the research leader for the USDA ARS Tree Fruit Research Laboratory, Wenatchee, Washington, since 2002, and research plant physiologist since 1988. Dr. Mathias has an outstanding record of achievement in research as a post-harvest physiologist working with deciduous fruits such as apple, peach, pear, and sweet cherry. His research on understanding the effects of 1-methylcyclopropene, also known as 1-MCP, on apple fruit quality laid the foundation for rapid uptake of this new technology by the Washington State industry and adoption around the world. Dr. Mathias is the recipient of one of the highest awards that are given within the USDA, the USDA ARS Technology Transfer Award. He received this for transforming apple storage technology, reducing fungicide use, and improving fruit quality, which recognizes his contributions toward adoption of MCP-based technology. Beyond MCP, however, Dr. Mathias has a broad research agenda that includes fruit metabolomics related to edible quality, especially firmness, texture, and volatile compounds that contribute to aroma and flavor. In addition, he's worked on physiological disorders during fruit development and ripening. As an administrator, Dr. Mathias led a strong research group where he's known for facilitating others to carry out excellent research and has advanced the careers of many others. He has hosted 6 visiting scientists and 5 postdoctoral research associates. Mathias is also adjunct graduate faculty at WSU, where he's graduated 2 MS and 4 PhD students, and has been a graduate committee member for 8 other students. He has a notable publication record with 102 peer-reviewed journal articles, many of which are in ASHS journals. Thank you for that as well. 40 international conference proceedings and 95 abstracts that reflect his long-term commitment to attending ASHS annual meetings. He's been a member of ASHS since 1983 and chair of the Post-Harvest Interest Group. So again, let's congratulate. It is at this point that I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Paul Boslin to continue the awards presentation.
Thank you, John. A lot of people say I'm growing older but not up, and one thing you learn in life is as you grow older, take something more than just the ordinary thing to thrill you, get you kind of excited. And I must say, being the chair of the awards committee was an exciting, thrilling thing in this old man's life, because you get to meet so many, or read about, and I'm going to meet here in a minute, some very interesting and excellent members of our society. And I tell the students out there, one was asking me, well, how do I get these awards later on? They're just beginning their career. And I said, watch on stage and listen, and you just follow their as their role model, and you'll be perfect. Each recipient of the Career Awards will be receiving an engraved mantle clock recognizing their achievement. These clocks will be sent to their offices for their convenience. It'd be inconvenient to take this clock. It's a beautiful clock. I've seen them. And so it's easier for us to ship them to their office than to give them on stage today. But they will be recognized by a certificate as they come up stage, on stage. And I also want to mention I'll also be doing the awards for the articles that were published in our journals. And there's maybe multiple names. And if you'd all like to come up, you're more than welcome. Okay, you decide if one person comes up or they all come up. Okay, the first award is the Outstanding Undergraduate Educator Award for Distinguished Contributions to Undergraduate Education in Horticultural Science. The award is presented to Dr. Cynthia L. Haynes from Iowa State University. Cindy amplifies what a teacher should be. She can spark an interest in horticulture for undeclared freshmen and masterfully hold seniors accountable to reach their potential. She finds ways to engage every student and help them become the best horticulturists they can be. Her actions also inspire other faculty to become the best teachers they can be. Congratulations, Cynthia. The Outstanding Graduate Educator Award for Distinguished Contributions to Graduate Education in Horticultural Science. The award is presented to Dr. William R. Graves from Iowa State University. On the campus of Iowa State University, and even on college campuses elsewhere, Dr. Graves is recognized as a faculty member deeply committed to graduate education. His track record for training and mentoring graduate students and forwarding the cause of graduate education is nothing short of outstanding. So you can't get a better compliment than that. Congratulations, William. The Outstanding Extension Educator Award for Exceptional Contributions to the Profession and Science of Horticulture, the Horticultural Industry, and or Home and Urban Horticulture through Innovative Extension Programs. The award is presented to Dr. Luis Ferguson from University of California, Davis. Dr. Ferguson has a distinguished career for 33 years as an extension specialist with high-impact programs in pistachio, olive, figs, citrus, and other tree crop production in California. Dr. Ferguson demonstrates strong leadership in tree fruit production, mechanical harvesting, and agricultural extension. She also has an extensive and impressive record of serving the horticultural industries in California, the United States, and internationally, plus extraordinary effect in international agricultural extension activities. Congratulations. Nice to see you again. The Outstanding Research Award for Distinguished Record of Research on Horticultural Crops and of Research that had made a significant contribution to scientific knowledge, basic or applied, dealing with or applicable to improvements in the breeding, selection, propagation, quality, harvesting, processing, marketing, or use of horticultural crops, plants, or products thereof. The award is presented to Dr. Robert N. Chirgino? I probably mispronounced it, but forgive me. Well, Robert's program in ornamental horticulture was initially devoted to biotechnology for woody ornamental plants. He devised regeneration systems that were among the first reports for regeneration of ornamental trees via non-zygotic somatic embryogenesis. He expanded his efforts to herbaceous ornamentals and published regeneration and genetic transformation systems for chrysanthemum and cineraria. Bob is probably best known for devising in vitro propagation protocols, developing molecular markers that genetically characterize ornamentals, discovering and releasing new plants, and investigating and solving disease problems of popular plants. Bob, I don't think we need any more horticulturists in the department. You did it all. Congratulations, Bob. The Outstanding Industry Science Award to a horticultural crop scientist working in the private sector and who has made outstanding and valuable contributions to horticultural science, horticultural industry, and the horticulture profession. The award is presented to Dr. Richard W. Jones, Monsanto Vegetable Seeds. Okay. For nearly 30 years, Rick has led the worldwide breeding effort for Monsanto vegetable seeds. In this role, he has developed numerous highly successful onion cultivars, implemented molecular breeding, computer software tools for the breeding programs, and mentored numerous junior plant breeders. Some of his accomplishments at Monsanto include the first sterile short-day onion hybrid cultivars, the first brown, red, and white short-day hybrid cultivars, and the first intermediate-day yellow hybrid cultivars. As a result of his breeding efforts, Monsanto is one of the leading seed companies for onion cultivars worldwide. Congratulations, Rip.
Good to see you, man.
Okay. Presentation of the Outstanding Publication Awards. Each year, the Society recognizes outstanding manuscripts that have been published in the Society's Journal of the American Society for Horticultural Science, Hort Science, or Hort Technology during the previous year. So this morning, I will announce the recipients for research publication in the year 2016. These researchers have done an outstanding job and deserve much respect. Please come to the stage as I announce your award. Each recipient will come to the stage for a certificate. A beautiful plaque has been sent to their offices, again, for your convenience. The Vegetable Publication Award for the most outstanding paper on vegetable crops. The recipients are Adrian E. Kleintop, James R. Myers, Dimas Echeverry, Henry J. Thompson, and Mark A. Brick for their manuscript, Total Phenolic Content and Associated Phenotypic Traits in a Diverse Collection of Snap Bean Cultivars, published in the Journal of American Society for Horticultural Science. Congratulations. The Fruit Publication Award for the most outstanding paper on fruit crops. The recipients are Geraldo Nunes, Hilda Patricia Rodriguez Armita, Rebecca L. Darnell, and James W. Olmsted for their manuscript Toward Marker-Assisted Breeding for Root Architecture Traits in Southern Highbush Blueberry, and it was published in the Journal of the American Society for Horticultural Science. When we mail the plaque, we'll mail the certificate. Oh, no, we have somebody. Good. I'll apologize if I don't pronounce your name. I mean, some of you may have gone through the school system. My major professor once told me, and you were the group that didn't learn phonetics. And I said, you're right. He says, my daughter was the same way. And you cannot pronounce any word, can you? I said, no, I have to hear everything, and then I know. So when I look at a word, I make up how it sounds. The Cross Commodity Publication Award for the most outstanding paper on horticultural cross-commodity research, including broadly applicable methodology, pre- and post-harvest physiology, genetics, anatomy, morphology, ecology, crop production systems, modeling, and management. The recipients are Mark W. Van Ursel, Jeffrey Weaver, Michael T. Martin, Runanito S. Durazzi, Enrico Matos, and Mark Heidecker for their manuscript, A Chlorophyll Fluorescent-Based Biofeedback System to Control Photosynthetic Lightning in Controlled Environment Agriculture, published in the Journal of the American Society for Horticultural Science. Congratulations, fellas. The Ornamental Publication Award for the most outstanding paper in floriculture, ornamental horticulture, or landscape horticulture. The recipients are Takanori Kuranuma and Hitoshi Watanabe for the manuscript Physiological and Morphological Traits and Competency for Carbon Sequestration of Several Green Roof Plants Under a Controlled Environmental System, published in the Journal of the American Society for Horticultural Science. Neither authors are here today, so again, we'll send the plaque and the certificate on to them. The Education Publication Award. The Education Publication Award for the most outstanding paper on horticultural education. The recipients are William J. Scarapa, Vivian Quinn, and Daniel J. Ward for the manuscript Comparing Conventional, Hybrid, and Distant Learning Courses in Horticulture, which was published in HortTech. Congratulations. The Extension Publication Award for the most outstanding paper in horticultural extension. The recipients are Richard Smith, Michael Kahn, Timothy Hartz, Patricia Love, and Barry Ferrara for the manuscript Nitrogen Dynamics of Cool Crop Production, Implications for Fertility Management and Environmental Protection, published in HortSci. Congratulations. That concludes my proportion of handing out the awards, but I encourage you for the awards winners. We have nice little stories on bulletin boards outside in the foyer, I guess it's called, out there in the area. Please stop by and look at those. And so before I turn over the ceremony back to John, I just want to leave you with one last thing. Being here in Hawaii, I think we all need to, you know, count our blessings. And then also remember your dreams. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. We're going to end the award ceremony with the presentation of the ASHS Scholars. The ASHS Scholars Scholarship Program was established by the ASHS Board of Directors in 2001 for the purpose of recognizing and supporting scholastic achievement and to encourage career development in horticultural science at the undergraduate level. Two scholarships of $1,500 each are given to two undergraduate students majoring in horticulture who meet the criteria of the program. I would like to encourage all undergraduate students and all graduate advisors to take advantage of this scholarship opportunity every year. The recipients of the scholarship for this year are Skylar Brazel of Iowa State University and Gray Simpson of the University of Georgia. Who do we have with? Skylar, are you? All right, great.
Gray Simpson will be mailed to us.
Okay, yes. It is fitting that we end with the ASHS Scholars, which highlights the young people in our field. There are many people here at the ASHS meeting who are just starting their careers, from students to new faculty members. As you listen to the presentations today of the fellows, the career awards, and the publication awards, I hope you'll be inspired to do good work. 31 years ago, I heard similar presentations, and what I've learned since then is that most of these individuals did not set out to be named a fellow or win an award. They were passionate about what they do, and they wanted to make an impact. Their success came about as a result of hundreds, even thousands of small events. They taught one class at a time, mentored one student or grower at a time, conducted one experiment, gave one talk or poster, then another. Wrote one grant, hosted one workshop or webinar, then another. I think you get the picture. By being here at ASHS, you have started the process that may someday lead you onto this stage as well. To everyone, thank you all for coming to ASHS this week and for sharing your knowledge. I hope you have a wonderful week and find those ideas that spark new developments in your research, teaching, and extension. And finally, I want to thank all of those who nominated today's awards recipients, and those committee members who put in much time and effort reviewing the packages and selecting today's recipients. So let's give everybody another round of applause.